Chapter 9, The Golden State Killer. I want to remind you that our story does have descriptions of violent crimes and sexual assaults. It may not be suitable for some listeners.
Michelle McNamara. I didn't know who this person was. Larry Poole, in a working group meeting, said, "Hey, there's this true crime author, blogger, that is interested in doing a story on the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker case." And he was just bringing it up to get a group consensus as to whether or not we wanted to cooperate. She was going to be writing an article for Los Angeles Magazine on the series. As a group, we decided, yes, we need to bring this monstrous case to the public's attention much more so than what it had been. I believe it was maybe 2 weeks after that, I get a call, and it's Michelle. And she introduced herself and asked if I had, was willing to talk to her a little bit about, my role in the case. And I said, sure, let's go ahead and chat for a bit. She, started asking questions about who I thought the East Area Rapist might turn out to be. I would just superficially answer them, and then she would immediately shoot back at me with very detailed bits of information out of the case that it became obvious that she had a much deeper level of knowledge about the case than who I typically was talking to when journalists were calling me. So the just the facts, ma'am type of approach did not go over well with Michelle, and she basically nicely called me out on it. She wanted to get her article spot on, and she wanted to do the case and the victims right. We had multiple phone conversations, multiple emails going back and forth, and I started to relax a little bit with her. I thoroughly enjoyed her wit and the intellectual back and forth that she was able to engage in on the case. Here's somebody that appears to get it. But at the same time, I'm on the law enforcement side. She's on the private side. What risk to my career am I taking if I tell her too much? And if I tell her too much and it gets out, what kind of trouble will I get in? And that's always a fear that law enforcement has when they're talking to the media. At a certain point, I decided I've got to roll the dice. I think she's somebody I can trust. And I need to be honest with her and open with her about this is what I am doing, because our conversation had gone so far past just the, this is what this offender did back, in 1978, and then he did this. We were starting to get into investigative strategies and theories, and I wanted to make sure she was armed with the full extent of how my knowledge had grown about this offender over time, and I wanted to be able to pass that on. And I gave her all the information that I had, why I thought Pete was such a good suspect. So when her article was about to be released, I was very nervous. She had promised me that anything I told her off the record would not be there, but it's one of those things, actions are louder than words. So her article came out, and I could almost feel the beads of sweat on my forehead as I'm reading this article as to, okay, when is she just going to burn me in this thing? And I got to the end, and I realized everything I had told her in confidence, she had protected. And she had done a tremendous job of writing an article to let the public know how horrific this offender was, how victims to this day are still suffering, and giving this series its place, its due, in terms of the magnitude of the offenses that this guy committed back in the 1970s and 1980s. It was at that point that I realized that I could truly trust Michelle. At that point, I opened up my entire playbook to her in terms of what I was doing, what I was pursuing, and she did the same.
One way that Michelle McNamara brings attention to the case is by renaming the offender the Golden State Killer. This moniker catches on immediately.
A couple of months after that article came out, She called me up and said, Paul, I need to ask you something. Sure, anything. She said she wanted to come up and meet with me and interview me face to face for her book. So at this point, Michelle becomes a significant partner in my investigation. We end up corresponding multiple times a day. I kept her abreast as to everything I was doing as I was investigating Pete. So when I would have a name, I would reach out to Michelle and say, hey, can you guys see what you can find on this guy? And so we started collaborating on the investigation. And I've likened Michelle to my investigative partner. I remember emailing Michelle after I got the results back on Pete. And it was a simple email saying, Pete has been eliminated with DNA. And she emailed back, and it was just, damn. And
Michelle McNamara was one of the first and greatest online sleuths. But she wasn't the only one trying to solve the Golden State Killer case. Across the country, in Georgia, Michelle Cruz was also logging on.
When Janelle was killed, I didn't talk. I mean, I even had a teacher put in my yearbook, will you please speak next year? Because I just did not talk. You know, the only people I talked to was some family, and I really didn't talk to them too much either. I was just very quiet. It wasn't until, you know, I started realizing this case is not moving. They're not finding the person responsible for killing my sister. I need to do something. I need to put myself out there. So I really had to learn how to talk to people. I was 40 years old when I decided to go back to college, and I started taking my criminal justice classes, doing that during the day. I was going to school part-time, and I was working a full-time job, graveyard, and I was raising four children on my own. And I would come home from work and school and research the East Area Rapist. I would say 6 to 8 hours a day for 10 years. That's what I did. I got on those pro boards, the forum, and started talking about it and researching myself, doing videos, posting those videos about the case. And then people started asking questions. They started turning in their own persons of interest to me. And at that point, I thought, okay, this is where I can help. I'm going to start researching them and eliminating them if I can. That was sort of my other job. I started emailing every media outlet that I could think of, and they started answering me back, and the case got bigger.
Around the same time, Paul was reevaluating his tactics.
With the elimination of Pete, I had to take a look at this case differently once again. Something really stood out to me. You know, I'm searching for a needle in a very, very large haystack, whether it be up in Sacramento or Stockton or the East Bay, or even down in Southern California with these large population bases. I could shrink the size of that haystack. Davis, California, where the East Area Rapist attacked three times in the matter of 4 weeks between June and July of 1978. There's my small haystack. So at this time, I'm now focusing in on Davis, California. And I'm also experiencing a very important change in my life, one that would have a major impact on my ability to investigate this case. I move over from being an employee of the sheriff's office and am hired by the Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office as a cold case investigator, being dedicated to going out and working these old cases. A lot of what I did from 2011 up until I went over to the DA's office, my bosses had no idea that I was working this case. They often didn't know where I was. I was sneaking out, getting out to Stockton and going down to San Jose and talking to people or visiting crime scenes. In many ways, I sort of went rogue, and that's part of my personality. As I mentioned, I don't do bored well, and so when I got bored, I decided I needed to do something in order to stay satisfied with my job. When I start reaching out and start talking to and visiting with victims, and I saw the trauma that they lived with to this day, this turned from a hobby to an obligation. And I decided no matter what, I got to continue working on this case. And in many ways, when I was in those depressed moments after my last prime suspects were being eliminated by DNA, what really brought me to continuing to work the case was thinking there is no way I can give up on it and just let these victims down. I now have freedoms that I never had before.
Davis, California is a college town of about 65,000 people, home to the University of California, Davis.
So we just entered into the city of Davis. This road, Russell Boulevard, is also the primary road to get into downtown Davis as well as to the west end of Davis. I believe it's entirely possible that our offender is brought to Davis for some business purpose, and he is sitting at this very intersection and watching the pretty little girls go by him and decides to follow one back and ends up making her a victim. This victim lived in an unusual location for the East Area Rapist to offend because she's living in an apartment complex. He avoided those. So why now is he choosing to attack her at a location that he typically would not want to commit an attack at? And I believe it's because he decided he was going to attack no matter what, and he made it work. This occurred June 7th, 1978. 2 days prior, he had attacked a couple down in Modesto. So now he's up here in Davis. She had her boyfriend over in the evening. They think that they hear something, but end up dismissing that sound. The boyfriend ends up leaving. She goes to bed, and then she's sleeping face down. She has a man climb on top of her, and then ends up pinning and holding her arms behind her back, like almost like in an arm lock. And she thinks it's her boyfriend playing tricks on her initially. And then turns out the East Area Rapist is telling her, no, I'm serious about this. Put your hands here. I'm going to tie you up. She starts fighting him, and he ends up hitting her multiple times in the face to get her to comply. And then once he gets her to comply and gets her bound up, then he ends up sexually assaulting her. So, you know, of course, Davis PD is responding to these sexual assaults as a progressive. And they did take a sexual assault kit. But, of course, all that evidence has been destroyed. Davis, just like all the other jurisdictions in Northern California, with the exception of Contra Costa Sheriff's Office, once statute of limitations was thought to have expired on these cases, they got rid of the evidence. The outrage of women finding out that their evidence on their attacks was just routinely being destroyed did not sit well. So laws were changed in order to extend the statute of limitations out. In fact, many property rooms are almost holding sexual assault evidence indefinitely, like homicide cases.
Today, there are still tens of thousands of untested rape kits in evidence rooms and police storage areas across the country. How many attackers could be arrested and cases solved if they were tested right now?
We just pulled up in front of the house for attack number three in Davis. I'm going to pull over onto the east side of this house because this is where the East Area Rapist got into this house. She had recently separated from husband, so it was her and her kids inside this house in her bed at the time that East Area Rapist came in. This is the victim that while the East Area Rapist is literally raping her, he is sobbing, saying, I hate you, Bonnie, I hate you, Bonnie, over and over again. So we were proceeding through our investigation and evaluating suspects because we were always looking, does he have a Bonnie in his life?
While traveling along these surface roads and highways, noting residential developments both new and old, Paul can't help but think about that third piece of paper, the diagram. Who drew it? Where is that place that's depicted? Pete may be eliminated, but that doesn't mean the Golden State Killer isn't a developer. Paul is about to get a new prime suspect.
His name was Mitch.
Mitch is a real estate developer who breaks ground on a new neighborhood in Davis at the same time the East Area Rapist attacks there. Mitch also lives in Cordova Meadows, home to the first cluster of East Area Rapist attacks.
So that caught my attention. His very first attack in June of 1976 was in Cordova Meadows. His third attack, his sixth attack, his eighth attack, and his 15th attack were all confined to this small neighborhood. And I'm looking at Mitch having an address in Cordova Meadows. Now I'm on to something. And this is when the adrenaline starts to pump, going, what's the likelihood that I'm finding a guy in Davis, the developer, and he's living in the heart of the strongest cluster of East Area rapist attacks that we have. I need to find out more about Mitch. And one of the primary tools that I use anytime I'm working a suspect is I try to identify ex-wives and ex-girlfriends, as they often are the best source of information. A woman scorned is my best friend. And I track down an ex-wife. I go up and I meet with her, and she proceeds to give me some background information about Mitch. Nothing that was overtly suspicious. He did have anger management issues. Yes, she confirmed that they had lived in Cordova Meadows and that he was also heavily involved in that project out in Davis. And then I start asking her some specific questions. Did he have a thing for younger women, teenage girls? She paused and she says, well, I know he used to peep on teenage girls. And she tells me a story about how she caught him up at night. He's not in bed. He's in a different room. She gets up. She sees him. He doesn't know that she's gotten up. And she sees him looking at the girls in their bedroom next door. She doesn't let him know and never confronts him about that.
Prowling, peeping, and burglary are all considered precursor behaviors to violence. When profilers see this kind of behavior, they wonder if they have a budding rapist on their hands.
One night when she comes home and he's been home alone, she sees that her house is completely dark and she goes, what's he doing? Why is he not here? He's out peeping on those girls again. I'm going to expose him. And she turns all the lights on and she sees him out returning to their house after being out prowling. And he's in the nude. This is significant to me, because this is at the same time when the East Area Rapist starts. His first two attacks in Cordova Meadows, he shows up with no pants on. He's nude from the waist down. And this guy that I've just found in Davis is prowling in the very same neighborhood, in the same state of undress, at the same time as the East Area Rapist. That's when the hairs on the arms go up. And you get that, I've got something now. I remember driving away from that interview, and I was pumped. After the elimination of Pete, I was feeling like I was directionless. And then I focused in on that smaller haystack, and I think I may have just found that needle in Davis. I had to go to Las Vegas. There was this California Homicide Investigators Association. It was a big meeting for homicide guys out of California, and I was going to be meeting Michelle there. Patton Oswalt was Michelle's husband. I was going to be the act for the Thursday night banquet, but Michelle and I had agreed that we would be meeting up during the course of that week in order to discuss the investigation, discuss the book. We spend the week there. Michelle and I say goodbye after that, and I fly back and continue my investigation into Mitch and into Davis, California, for the East Area Rapist series. I may really have the East Area Rapist this time. I had purpose, energy levels were high, and I was digging hard. Michelle and I were communicating back and forth. I'm letting her know where I'm at with my investigation. And I remember her emailing me. She had a trip for her daughter planned. And it was like a camping trip, if I remember right. Possibly for the Girl Scouts. I'm not entirely sure. Or the Brownies. It was a very young daughter. And she had written me saying she was, you know, en route up to this campground location and was passing through Santa Barbara, where the East Area Rapist had attacked three times. And she said, this just is not right, you know, to be with my daughter, with all these young girls, and to be passing through a location where such evil had occurred just did not sit well with her. And I responded back, and I said, well, good luck. You've got your hands full with the girls, and, you know, let me know how it goes. So we ended that email chain. I continued with my investigation. She had sent me another email after that that I hadn't had a chance to open. And then on a evening, and I want to say it was a Friday evening, I get an email from somebody who I had become friends with out of Stockton. And that email only contained a link to a article for People magazine. And I opened that link up to an article about how Patton Oswalt's wife had passed away in her sleep. And it hit. I was stunned. I was like, this can't be right. This has got to be fake news. I had just seen her in Vegas. We had just emailed. She was talking about this trip with her daughter. This can't be right. I end up reaching out to Paige Nealon in Sacramento saying, have you heard about this? And Paige confirmed, yeah, that's true. And it was a blow. I had just lost, you know, my investigative friend. I remember sitting down, and it was that same type of hopeless feeling, like after a DNA elimination of a prime suspect, but worse. And it's like, what am I going to do? You know, I had worked this case for so long without Michelle. But once she got into the case and was in my life, there was a spark. And that spark just was snuffed out. And there was a true sense of despair that I was feeling. I truly felt that I had lost a family member. And I end up going and opening up my email. I ended up writing to Michelle one last time. And I noticed in her previous email that she had sent me a link. She had an attachment. And I got around to downloading that attachment. And in many ways, she was still helping me even after she wasn't around. Michelle's family and Patton had invited some of us investigators from the working group down to attend her memorial, and there was no way I was going to miss that. And I sat with Ken Clark from Sac Sheriff's office. Larry Poole was also there. In some ways was cathartic, and in some ways it was re-emphasizing that I have to get back in the saddle again on the case. I know I'm close. She's going to want me to continue, and I got to do this. So after getting back home, after being down for Michelle's memorial, that's when I had to double down and see what I could do with Mitch. At this point, I knew I had to get his DNA. I reach out to the FBI and ask for assistance in order to be able to get a surreptitious DNA sample. And I'm telling the FBI agent, we need to do this right. The FBI puts a team on Mitch. They follow him around. Eventually, he goes to a restaurant and is eating lunch with two other males sitting at the table. They finish lunch and leave. One of the FBI agents goes and distracts the waiter to make sure he doesn't come in and collect that valuable DNA evidence, while another agent goes and snatches the fork and drinking glass that Mitch had used. So we now have Mitch's DNA. So I'm sitting, just waiting for this to come back, and then we can go and effect an arrest on the East Area Rapist. Then I get an email from Paige. Mitch has been eliminated. Once again, that feeling of, how could it not be him? And I started thinking about the surreptitious collection and hitting the lead agent up going, there was two other men sitting at that table. Are you sure you got DNA from the right person? But I was assured, no, we got the right DNA. And I had to just accept that Mitch was not the guy I was looking for. This put me in a tailspin. Though I felt my investigative strategy was solid, the smaller haystack approach was a good one to take, but nothing looked promising to me. And I thought, I might be at the end now.
Paul puts the Golden State Killer case to the side for a moment And it's during this time, while thinking about another case, that a new idea hits him.
In February of 2017, I was called over to the sheriff's office to participate in a conference call with San Bernardino. This conference call dealt with a homicide of an Asian female, Eunsoon Jun, whose live-in boyfriend, Larry Vanner, had bludgeoned to death and then put her in a shallow grave underneath her own house. We always referred to this case as the kitty litter case because he had dumped a ton of kitty litter over the body to prevent the smell from getting out. He was shortly arrested after that homicide and ultimately pled guilty to it, so he was in custody. Larry Vanner wasn't his real name, and we knew that because he had used at least 20 different names over the course of his life, had 10 different social security numbers and dates of births. He obviously is hiding his identity. We didn't know who he was, but we did see that he had an arrest back in 1986 down in the Santa Cruz area for child abandonment. And he had abandoned a 6-year-old little girl named Lisa Jensen. Well, we proved that Lisa was not biologically related to him. He was not her father. And we were convinced that she was a missing girl from somewhere across the nation. So for almost 15 years, we had tried to identify who Lisa really was. So this conference call that I was invited to, Detective Peter Headley from San Bernardino, starts detailing that he had worked with a genealogist and they had identified Lisa as a missing girl out of New Hampshire. Her name was Dawn Bodin. And I was asking him, how did you do that? And he indicated, well, we had done this autosomal DNA testing, and he was saying they'll send to Morgan this and SNP testing that, but he wasn't real sure exactly about the technology, but said this Barbara Ray Venter was the one that had taken this type of DNA and used it in order to identify Lisa as Dawn Bodin. I walked out of that meeting going, I need to figure out exactly how that's done, and I need to call this Barbara Ray Venter ASAP.
I'm Barbara Ray Venter. So there's genealogy itself, which is basically, that's family history research. Then there's genetic genealogy, which is how I would normally describe myself, which is basically applying genetics to genealogy or family history research. And then there's what you're calling investigative genealogy or forensic genealogy, where you're then taking basically the genetic genealogy and applying that to solving a crime.
I was like, why hasn't anyone done this before to try and solve homicides?